It is going to take us a while to sort through this mess. You are officially under investigation for subversive activities, disclosure of sensitive information, and violation of Article 13 conduct on becoming an officer. Stubbs voiced all this without much emotion, as if running on autopilot. Reese stood slowly. Bridger looked like he wanted to be anywhere except for right where he was. Stubbs put the emails back into the stack. As he stood, Reese's hand instinctively went to the back right section of his hip, where he always carried his issued SIG P226 9mm pistol. He couldn't help but think that had it been about 150 years earlier, the government would be looking for two new federal agents. Chapter 4. Dr. Peter O'Halloran exuded the confidence of a man at the top of his profession. In the weeks following September 11, 2001, Dr. O'Halloran turned the reins of his highly successful spine surgery center over to his team of surgeons and joined the Army to do what he felt was his duty. As one of the best spine surgeons in the country, Peter had performed procedures on everyone from professional athletes at the height of their careers to aging politicians looking for a reprieve from constant nerve pain. He knew that men would be gravely wounded in this fight, and he wanted to put his ample skills to work to keep those men alive. A waiver was quickly granted to bypass the age restrictions, and, much to the dismay of his wife and children, Dr. Peter O'Halloran soon found himself Lieutenant Colonel O'Halloran of the U.S. Army Reserve, spending more time in uniform in Iraq and Afghanistan than in his spine clinic in La Jolla, California. It had only been 2 days since the ambush and subsequent interrogation, but physically, Reese was ready to leave the hospital. He had been asked to stop in and see Dr. O'Halloran before he left for good, and upon his discharge, the nurse in charge of the shift walked him to the surgeon's office. O'Halloran greeted Reese warmly and invited him to sit. The doctor swiveled his chair to face a desktop computer and selected a file before rotating the screen so that Reese would have a better view of it. He then pulled up an image on the screen that was clearly a brain scan. It immediately reminded Reese of the black-and-white forward-looking infrared FIR imagery they used on the battlefield, with its glowing white highlights showing three-dimensional relief on a black background. The doctor used his mouse to put a cursor over a white blob on the image.
"Two of your men came in here wounded. We fought as hard as we could to save them, but their injuries were just too severe. As part of our initial assessment, we did scans to determine the extent of their brain trauma, and besides a significant amount of shrapnel, we found this. This is the CT scan we took of Petty Officer Morales' brain. You see this?" He pointed to a white blob on the screen. "This is an abnormal mass that is not consistent with a traumatic injury. The pathologist who did the autopsy believes that the mass is an oligodendroglioma, a rare and malignant brain tumor. The lab will confirm or deny that suspicion, but he knows his stuff, and I agree with his assessment based on the imaging."
He clicked the mouse and a second image was displayed on the screen.
"This is Lieutenant Pritchard's brain. As you can see here, he has a slightly smaller but similar tumor. The pathologist and I believe that it is the same type."
A third image came up.
"This is your brain, James. Now, we have no way of knowing for sure, but the mass on your brain appears to be similar in size and shape to that of your men. If we were in the States, I would bring you in for a biopsy, but we can't do that here."
Reese's mouth went dry, and he suddenly had an overwhelming desire to be with his wife and daughter.
"I don't want you to panic, James. This could be a variety of things, and a malignancy is just one of them."
"What?" Reese stammered. How rare is that, Doc? It seems crazy to me that three guys our age would have brain tumors."
"Extremely rare, James. The incidence of this type of tumor is roughly 0.3 per 100,000. Only about 2% of all brain tumors are of this type. Let's assume that yours is something different, since we can't confirm it here. But for two men on the same team, both in their 20s, to have this same type of tumor,
O'Halloran shook his head.
The odds are astronomical.
Have you and your men been exposed to any chemical or biological agents? Been in any nuclear facilities? Anything like that?
No. Not that I'm aware of. I mean, when we first invaded Iraq, there were a bunch of chem-bio scares, but Pritchard was probably in high school at the time. And as far as I know, they were just that, scares. A team was hit with a mustard gas agent of some sort, but nowhere near where I was operating. As far as these two guys being together, nothing out of the ordinary.
Well, keep thinking about it and let me know if you come up with anything. This is incredibly unusual. Like I said, we can't do any more here, but when you get back stateside, you need to get checked out, just to be sure. I'm almost done with this deployment. It's been a long year, but I'll be back at my California clinic early next month. I want you to come up to La Jolla and see me. There are some colleagues of mine who specialize in brain research that I'd like for you to meet. You haven't had any blurred vision, headaches, anything like that, have you?
No, sir, Reese lied, needing time to think.
How about Petty Officer Morales or Lieutenant Pritchard? Did they or any of your men mention any unusual headaches?
No, but that wouldn't be out of the ordinary with this crew. The teams aren't really a culture where people complain about those sorts of things. They think it might take them out of the fight.
I see, the doctor said thoughtfully. I'm sorry about your men. I know that probably doesn't mean much, but I really am. Get yourself home safely. Hug your family. Bury your men. And make an appointment with my office for when I get back. Take care, James.
Reese walked out of the medical facility, a man adrift. Truly, he was already gone, occupied with the thoughts of the families of sons, husbands, and fathers whose bodies, or what was left of them, were being put into bags, then into flag-draped coffins for their final trip home. Chapter 5 Naval Special Warfare Command, Coronado, California. The aide knocked before entering Admiral Pilsner's office.
Sir, the SecDef's office is on the line.
Tell Howard to get in here and then put them through, the Admiral responded harshly.
Yes, sir.
The aide scampered back out the door. The Admiral's JAG, Captain Leonard Howard, entered without knocking less than 30 seconds later. The phone on the Admiral's desk rang and he pressed the button to put it on speaker.
This is Admiral Pilsner standing by for the Secretary.
Thank you, Admiral.
An unidentified voice responded. Secretary Hartley will be with you momentarily. After close to 5 minutes of waiting, the line sparked to life.
Good afternoon, Madam Secretary. What can I do for you?
The Admiral said cheerfully in greeting.
What the fuck happened over there, Admiral?
A furious Lorraine Hartley asked.
Ma'am, we did our best to manage the situation, but obviously we didn't fully achieve our mission.
Your best? You're the goddamn WARCOM, Admiral, and this is your best?
Madam Secretary, we are doing everything we can to clean this up as soon as possible.
I'm losing confidence in your ability to do that. First of all, I want the survivors tied up in the investigation over there as long as possible. I don't want the American public falling in love with these guys during the media storm around the funerals. I want them out of sight, out of mind. And I want the responsibility hung on their shoulders. I want that troop commander to be a modern-day Custer. I want charges brought against him yesterday.
Leonard Howard spoke up.
Madam Secretary, this is Captain Leonard Howard. We would have a difficult time charging Commander Reese with anything under the UCMJ until a full investigation has been completed.
Get your head out of your ass, Howard. You find something to charge him with. We have so many federal crimes on the books, the Department of Justice can't even count them all, and you're telling me you can't come up with something? Haven't you ever heard the phrase, show me the man, I'll show you the crime? Charge him with as much as you can, but don't lock him up. We need him to be a free man for this to end appropriately. Clean up this mess, gentlemen, or you'll wish you'd never met me.
Both men heard a click, and the line went dead. Pilsner looked at his JAG.
Call Horn, ASAP. We need a plan in place before those men are back on the ground stateside.
and tell the NCIS guys to turn up the heat on Reese.
Chapter 6 Bagram Air Base, Bagram, Afghanistan. The days passed slowly while Reese was confined to Bagram. His men were being laid to rest in front of their devastated families while Reese was stuck halfway around the world, unable to look their wives, children, and parents in the eyes and assure them that he would find out what had led them into such a devastating ambush. He knew that he'd be crucified by Warcom, and as far as he was concerned, he deserved it. He'd gotten all of his men killed, the cardinal sin of a combat leader. And for what? Some target they didn't know shit about? Add in the stress of a probable rare brain tumor, and Reese's head was spinning. He was recalled almost daily to answer further questions from the NCIS goons, and continued to answer all inquiries about the mission, while refusing to answer the ones about his personal emails. The questions from the NCIS had the smell of people with an agenda. Single sentences from emails going back over 15 years were extracted to support a preconceived narrative. It was obvious to Reese that NCIS was not interested in what actually happened in the lead-up to and execution of the mission. They were there to put the blame on Reese and Reese alone. It had been brutal, but he had taken it. After a cruel 2 weeks of sleepless nights thinking about the brain tumors and of circular interrogations from NCIS, Reese was finally cleared to go home. He leaned back in his seat on the C-5 as it gathered speed down the runway, nose up, banking tightly to quickly gain altitude and get outside the range of enemy small arms and RPGs, leaving Bagram in the background. Reese's thoughts turned to what had happened at home in his absence. The command had mobilized. Casualty assistance officers and teams had been dispatched to try to beat the 24-hour news cycle to the front doors of families scattered across the country. Mothers and fathers, wives and children, who would get the news every military family dreads. The unexpected knock on the door. The chaplain, an officer, a friend. The unthinkable. The screaming, the tears, the kids, the funerals, the blame. The blame. It was my fault. I was the senior man on the ground. Responsibility lies with me. And I couldn't even be there to deliver the news in person, to do my duty. The flight would be a good way to get his thoughts in order. He would call his wife from Germany, where he would have a few hours to decompress while the pilots had their mandated crew rest. How can I go home and face my family when 28 Rangers, 4 air crew, and 36 SEALs of my task unit are going home in boxes? That's war, Reese. No, the enemy was good, but they were not that good. This ambush was too well conceived and too effective. It was months, if not a year, in planning. The explosives. What were they and how were they detonated? Why didn't any insurgents spill out of that compound with the detonation of the first explosives? Was there anyone in there at all? How did they know exactly where the helos would land? Why were they forced to go on this mission? Why was NCIS so pointed in their questioning so soon after the mission? What am I missing? Chapter 7 Capstone Capital Corporate Offices, Los Angeles, California. Steve Horn was not accustomed to waiting for anything. First, his tasty little assistant had made him wait 5 minutes for his beloved green tea, and now his most loyal lieutenant was running late, something he would not tolerate. The 6'4" former Stanford quarterback sat behind a desk of polished walnut that he now visually inspected for any sign of dust or grime. He wore a finely tailored suit of charcoal cashmere that cost more than most families brought home in a month, cut not for comfort, but to display his muscular physique. His tan neck was framed by a rigid spread collar and a violet Hermes necktie bound with a massive Windsor knot. A casual visitor would have thought that fortune was arriving any minute to shoot him for the cover, but his staff knew better. This was Horn's everyday attire, Horn was the very image of vanity personified. If Horn had ever consulted a mental health professional, he would likely be diagnosed with an antisocial personality disorder. He felt absolutely no empathy for his fellow man and actually relished the discomfort of others. A counselor might explore whether this detachment resulted from the disinterest of his socialite parents during his upbringing, or the harsh punishments dispensed by some of his many nannies. Maybe it was his failure to bond with a caretaker, or perhaps he was born a sociopath. He would never know, because he would never think to question what to him was as natural as breathing. To Horn, being ruthless was a competitive advantage. An email on the 27-inch screen of his iMac indicated the arrival of the tardy lieutenant. Phone calls or door knocks from his receptionist were not acceptable. Despite his strong desire to hear what the man had to say, Horn made him wait 10 excruciating minutes in the lavishly decorated reception area. With Horn, everything was about power, and he spared no opportunity to remind everyone that he was in charge, a fact that no one but him questioned. The touch of a key on the desk phone indicated to the receptionist that he was ready to receive his appointment, and she quickly and sympathetically ushered Saul Agnon through the thick oak doors and into Horn's office. If Horn's appearance signaled power, strength, and grace, Agnon's did the opposite. He was slight of build, with small features, pallid skin, and a generally disheveled manner. His suit was cheap and off the rack, fitting him accordingly. His shoes were worn and unpolished. His fingernails were soft from nervous biting. His hair thinning and greasy. Horn observed him with disgust as he passed through the doorway, defeated and hopeless, with the posture of a man headed to his own execution. Horn had always suspected Saul of being a homosexual, but couldn't fathom a gay man with such a hopeless lack of style. Saul Agnon brought two things to the table, though, that made him indispensable: cunning intelligence and unwavering loyalty. Agnon worshipped Horn the way an abused animal serves its cruel master, doing anything for a hint of approval or sign of pleasure.
"Not only are you late, Saul, but you come in here looking like a fucking rat. I thought Sears went out of business. Where did you get that suit? Don't sit down. This won't take long. What do you have for me?"
"Sir, I'm so sorry for being late. There's no excuse. It's just that..."
"You're right, there is no excuse. Stop wasting my time with your contrition."
"Sir, the ambush went as planned. You've seen the media reports."
"As planned? I'm reading that there were survivors. That was not the plan. The Admiral called. Hartley is pissed. She wants this thing handled before it gets out of control."
"Sir, I'm working the issue, and we will deal with it. This was always a possibility. There's another problem, though."
Agnon paused to gain the courage to continue.
"A doctor in Bagram discovered the tumors and was asking too many questions, but he'll be out of the picture soon. We'll use what they call a green on blue, since they are common enough not to raise suspicion. Our team on the ground found an Afghan military officer with a sick child. We promised to get the child medical care in the United States in exchange for one of his troops taking out the doc. Done deal."
"So now we have to arrange care for some sick kid from a third world shithole."
"No, sir. We have no intention of making good on that promise."
Saul glanced down at his small spiral notebook.
"Next item. As you know, Lieutenant Commander Reese survived the mission, as did one of his men. Reese is in the air now and will land in Coronado later this morning. Holder is headed to the other man's apartment as we speak."
"What's your plan for Commander Reese?"
"That situation is fluid, sir. The other events may have put him on guard, and we could have a problem on our hands. We don't have adequate personnel in the area to handle someone of his capability without the element of surprise."
"Saul, he's been put through the ringer by the investigators and has flown halfway around the world. He'll be jet-lagged and exhausted. All he's going to want to do is give his kids a hug, bang his wife, and forget about Afghanistan."
"Kid, sir, singular, he has one daughter."
"Whatever.
Get some gangbangers from L.A. or Mexico to take him out. Make it look like a home invasion robbery. Just make sure it gets done. We have cops on the payroll that can arrange it, but don't let them know he's a SEAL.
I don't want them going sentimental patriot on us.
Then get out of here. I have bigger matters to deal with.
Chapter 8. Coronado, California. The mammoth C-5 Galaxy touched down at Naval Air Station North Island and taxied slowly toward the small World War II-era terminal building. Upstairs, in the barely occupied passenger area, James Reese stood and stretched, trying to shake the exhaustion and jet lag. He long since shed his uniform for jeans and a T-shirt, the only connection to his combat load being the AOR-1 patterned pack and the hiking boots he wore nearly every day of his life. This pair was almost ready for the dumpster, he thought as he waited for the signal to deplane. He looked down at his right boot and smiled as he saw the unmistakable evidence that his 3-year-old daughter had decorated it with a magic marker. The other boot, covered with the blood of his dying teammates, quickly wiped the smile away. He'd taken an Ambien to try to force himself to sleep on the long flight, but it wore off after 3 hours, and he spent the rest of the trip in a surreal state of exhaustion, grief, and drug-induced fog. He'd replayed the events leading up to the op over and over in his head, trying to find an answer to what had led them into the ambush, some clue that he'd missed, some shred of evidence that would explain what happened. He found no answers, only a blinding headache, like the ones he'd had leading up to the ill-fated mission. He scrolled through pictures of his daughter on his iPhone, his eyes misting over from the pain of his months-long absence from fatherhood. He couldn't get home soon enough. Down in the massive cargo area, he steered clear of the pallets of gear and brushed past some Air Force ground crew personnel who were already preparing to offload what looked like enough crates and boxes to fill a Walmart. He grabbed his oversized gear bag and weapons case and headed toward the ramp. The rest of his gear, along with that of his troop, had been palletized and sent back with Boozer on an earlier flight while Reese was spending quality time with the assholes from NCIS. He set down his heavy bag and pulled his sunglasses over his eyes before walking down the ramp and into the blazing Southern California sunshine. Love it or hate it here, the weather was always good. There would be no one to meet him, no running hug with the wife and daughter, or Navy band playing God Bless America. Just a Navy base going about its business on a stateside Monday morning. There was always enough back-and-forth traffic that he figured he could bum a ride to his truck at Team 7 from someone headed to the amphibious base. He was about to set down the unwieldy weapons case to open the door to the terminal building when it opened as if on cue and was held wide by a heavily tattooed arm belonging to a short, muscular figure holding a giant cup of Starbucks. The bearded man's face turned into a beaming smile behind a white-framed pair of surf shop sunglasses. The face was that of Ben Edwards, Reese's closest friend and former teammate. Reese and Ben had gone through buds together, deployed together as enlisted SEALs, and maintained a close friendship even after Reese became an officer and Ben migrated into the black side of naval special warfare. Ben had since left the Navy for the nebulous world of the nation's intelligence agencies, though the lines between the two had grown increasingly blurred in the years following 9/11.
"Welcome home, bro," said Edwards as he offered his hand.
"For a second I thought you were a homeless guy," answered Reese as he grabbed the shorter man for a bear hug.
"I figured you might need a ride. Let me get your gear bag."
"Where's my coffee?" Reese asked with a smile. Despite being identical in age, the two men walked through the small terminal building, looking like complete opposites. The tall, clean-cut figure of James Reese and the stocky, ink-covered Edwards dressed in shorts and battered flip-flops. They were almost a caricature of the stereotypical differences between officers and enlisted SEALs. As they headed into the parking lot, Edwards fished into the pocket of his black hooded sweatshirt, and the rear hatch of a black Chevrolet Tahoe began to arc toward the sky.
"Does Hertz have a fleet of rental Suburbans and Tahoes just for spooks?"
chided Reese as he lifted the heavy black weapons case into the cargo area of the SUV.
Yeah, but they're not up armored, so don't drive us through any shit neighborhoods.
Oh, yeah, tons of slums here in Coronado, joked Reese.
My truck is at the team, Reese said as they climbed into the cab of the Tahoe.
This thing is plush. What is this, velvet?
He asked, rubbing his hand across the leather armrest.
Anything is plush compared to that shitbox you roll around in, man. When are you going to get rid of that thing?
Ha, I'm driving the cruiser until it dies. That's the whole point of having one.
Us officers don't get those fat re-enlistment bonuses.
Ben laughed.
You were enlisted once too, remember? All that tax-free re-enlistment money could have been yours.
He put the SUV in gear, slammed what was left of his coffee, and in a long, practiced motion that had obviously become second nature, packed a can of Copenhagen that appeared out of nowhere with his right index finger before pinching a huge dip into his lower lip.
How's quitting treating you?
Reese asked mischievously.
Nobody likes a quitter, buddy.
Ben smiled back, maneuvering the vehicle out of the parking lot and toward the gate.
So, I'm guessing you didn't tell Lauren you were coming home because you figured the plane would never get here on time?
Yeah, man, you know how those C-5s are, always breaking down. Usually in Hawaii when the air crew decides they need to spend 4 days in paradise waiting for a part to show up. Always cool to surprise her and Lucy anyway.
I went by the house to check on them when I heard about the op. I knew from Boozer you weren't hurt bad and I wanted to make sure they didn't get bad info.
Appreciate it, brother.
The inside of the SUV was dead quiet as they rolled through the gate of the air station. Clearly, the small talk was over.
I know what you're thinking, man, Reese said angrily without looking over. My troop got wiped out. What in the fuck happened out there?
It was a shit op from the beginning. None of us wanted to go in the first place. It's my fault. I should have pushed back. I should have refused. Instead, I said, aye, aye, sir, like some dumbass ensign and got all my guys killed.
I'm sure you did what you could, Reese. Everyone in the community has heard it was a shit op. What the fuck were they thinking anyway? When was the last time they pushed a target down to you instead of you guys coming up with your own?
That's what was crazy, Ben. You know it's never like that. If anything, they're telling you what targets you can't hit, not which ones you have to. Now they're going to fry my ass for their bad intel.
And I deserve it for letting my guys go out. You don't deserve shit, Reese. You're as solid as it gets, and everybody knows that.
Yeah, I hope you told that to all of my guys' wives and kids at their funerals.
Sorry, man. I'm not trying to put this on you.
What are you doing on the West Coast, anyway?
Looking for talent, man. Workload is crazy these days with the conventional stuff winding down. We're constantly needing new guys. You ready to come work with me yet?
I'm sure as hell going to need a job, but I think I've had enough of this shit. When they throw me out of the Navy, I'll open a sandwich shop or something.
You'd have to touch mayo, Ben said, shaking his head. That would never work.
Yeah, well, I'll have to think of something else then.
Reese's hatred of condiments was well known throughout the Naval Special Warfare community. As they passed the Hotel Del Coronado and turned right toward the Silver Strand, they passed Miguel's Cocina, where they'd eaten with their wives dozens of times over the years. Well, with Reese's wife and each of Ben's three former brides.
Too early for a margarita?
Ben joked.
Never too early for a margarita.
Just don't take me to Rick's. Don't think I could show my face in there right now, said Reese, referring to a hole-in-the-wall SEAL hangout bar in downtown Coronado.
Operators would return from deployments and toast their fallen comrades in blackout sessions that often turned ugly. Rick's was a safe haven where they could blow off some steam without ending their careers. And there was always a steady supply of willing women looking to be a SEAL wife for the night.
Ah, yes. Rick's Palm Bar and Grill, home of the world-famous Slamburger. I think I met wife number two in there.
I think you did, Reese said, remembering happier times.
I'm actually banging this little spinner of a bartender in there now.
Yeah? How old is he? Reese asked, grinning.
Fuck you. Heather, I think her name is. A bit of a frog hog, but she does this amazing thing with her tongue.
Okay, stop, said Reese, holding up his hands in mock defeat. I don't want to know.
They passed through the gate to the amphibious base after showing their IDs and steered around a group of exhausted and soaking wet buds candidates running down the road with an inflatable boat balanced on their heads.
Shit, must be Hell Week, poor bastards,
Ben commented without a touch of sympathy for the aspiring frogmen.
I'd trade 100 Hell Weeks for the week I've had, Reese said, mostly to himself.
Ben spotted Reese's white 1988 FJ62 Toyota Land Cruiser in the parking lot of the team building and pulled into the empty spot behind it. Both men were quiet as they transferred Reese's gear into the truck. When they were finished, the two friends faced one another and Ben Edwards extended his arm for a handshake.
Call me if that piece of shit doesn't start.
Thanks for the ride, man.
Reese needed to check in at the team before heading home to surprise his wife and daughter. He walked across the parking lot and up the sidewalk of what looked more like a small office building than a den of amphibious commandos. He wondered how the guys would look at him as he took a deep breath and opened the door to what had always been a safe haven. He barely made it through the entrance when a chief from one of the other platoons went running by him with panic on his face. He knew immediately that something was wrong. "What's going on, chief?" Reese pled. The 40-something chief spun around and faced Reese as he slowed his pace to a backward jog.
"Cops are at Boozer's. You need to get your ass over there,"
was all he said, before turning and running out the front door of the building. Reese sprinted after him and covered the distance to his cruiser in seconds.
Chapter 9. San Diego, California. Boozer was a bachelor and lived in a cookie-cutter apartment complex just off Interstate 5 near UCSD. It was the kind of place you'd find in every suburban city in the country, except the rent was probably double or triple what you'd pay in Middle America. Identical clusters of buildings and parking lots where young professionals and grad students lived among one another in anonymity, their lives separated by metal studs and cheap Chinese drywall. There was no traffic this late in the morning, and Reese drove like a man possessed. Boozer was a stud who could certainly handle himself, but Reese had an annoying feeling that this was not going to end well. Reese had been to Boozer's place only once before, and he couldn't remember which building was his in the maze of two-story garden-style apartments. He took a guess, then turned right as he passed the leasing office, and blew by the first turn when he caught a cluster of emergency vehicles to his left. He slammed on the brakes and threw the truck into reverse before cutting the wheel hard and stomping on the accelerator. When he reached the police cars, he quickly pulled into an empty space, slammed the shift lever into park, and raced toward the apartment. He ignored the police officer commanding him to stop and bounded up the stairwell. Brushing past an EMT, he tried to make it through the open front door of Boozer's apartment, but was grabbed by two burly cops in uniform.
"He's one of my guys. I need to get in there," Reese begged as he struggled against the two men who had pinned him to the door jamb. "You don't want to see this, sir," the older of the two officers said as they loosened their grip.
Reese broke free and stumbled into the living room of the apartment as the too familiar smell of blood and death filled his nostrils. Two detectives in civilian clothes with handguns on their hips were standing in front of a light brown futon couch, one of them holding a large DSLR camera with a flash sticking upward. They turned toward the commotion, and when they did, Reese could see Boozer's lifeless body sitting in boxers and a white T-shirt, his legs extended toward the two detectives. His usually pasty white legs were deep purple in color, and his face wore a mask of shock. A gaping exit wound was visible just above his left ear, and a massive amount of blood, brain, and skull were splattered across the couch and onto the lampshade sitting on the end table. A Sig Sauer P226 was lying in an awkward position on his lap, the hammer cocked and ready to fire. Reese stood in shock, unable to move or speak. The two uniformed officers who had restrained him took him gently by the shoulders and steered him with care through the door of the apartment and into the hallway. Both had served combat tours in Iraq as reservists and knew the familiar look of a grief-stricken comrade. Reese sat down on the steps and put his head in his hands. What in the hell was going on? How could so many bad things happen at once? Various officers and NCOs from Team 7 had arrived at the scene, and the chief that Reese had seen in the hallway guided him toward the parking lot, making him sit on the tailgate of an ambulance. Reese's boss, the commander of SEAL Team 7, appeared minutes later along with his command master chief, the senior enlisted SEAL in the command. Commander Cox was a good leader, a fair guy, and a legit warrior. He'd obviously had other plans for today, as he and the master chief were both in their full dress uniforms, something you didn't see often in the teams. He'd probably been dealing with family members of the men killed downrange. The two men quietly conferred with the other officers and NCOs on the scene, as well as the detective in charge of the investigation. One of the enlisted SEALs pointed toward Reese, the commander turning to walk toward his grieving subordinate. Still seated with his head in his hands, Reese did not see his boss approach until he was a few feet away. He started to rise to greet him, but Cox pushed him downward with a firm but kind hand on the shoulder.
"Rough week, Reese. I know. I'm sorry about your troop, and I'm sorry about Boozer. There will be plenty of time later to point fingers, but for now I need to worry about you. I can't stand by while another life is wasted, like Boozer's. Danner's taking you to Balboa. I want you cleared by the docks before you take another step. Does Lauren know that you're back?"
"No, sir. I was going to drive home after I checked in at the team. Then I came straight here."
"Get cleared at Balboa, and then head home. Take the rest of the week off. And on Monday, we need to sit down and talk about the op."
Chapter 10. By the time the docks at Balboa Naval Medical Center had cleared Reese to go home, it was after 6 p.m. Dan Harvey, a lieutenant from the operations shop, had driven him to Balboa and babysat him all day as the doctors did their thing. He drove Reese back to the team to get his truck and was kind enough not to say a word during the trip. After telling the shrinks what they needed to hear to be sure he wasn't going to eat a bullet or chase a handful of pills with a bottle of Jameson, the last thing Reese needed was some well-meaning new guy trying to cheer him up. His wife and daughter would be somewhere in the dinner, bath, book, bedtime ritual, and he'd arrive just in time to see his little princess before she went to bed. Reese thought he knew what love was when he met his beautiful wife, Lauren, but he'd never known complete, unconditional love until his daughter, Lucy, was born. She was her mother's spitting image, with enormous blue eyes and blonde curls. Reese had killed insurgents on multiple continents, gone through the most rigorous military training in the world, and had stood his ground in confrontations with both admirals and Master Chief petty officers. But he was helpless in resisting the will of his 3-year-old baby girl. When she said sit, he sat. When she yelled, "Daddy," he dropped everything and bowed to her wishes. She had him wrapped around her tiny little finger, and they both loved every minute of it. After 6 long months, he was going to see her face in person in the next few minutes. He couldn't wait to scoop her up in his arms and hug her for as long as she would put up with it. He thanked Dan for the ride and hopped into his cruiser that one of the chiefs had driven back to the team, leaving the door unlocked and the key in the visor. It wasn't like anyone was going to steal his truck from the Team 7 parking lot. The chief obviously didn't know the weapons case was in the back. With all the turmoil of the day, Reese had never gotten a chance to turn it into the arms room. He was always wary about driving around with a box of weapons from work in his personal truck, given California's crazy gun laws, but under the circumstances, he decided to risk it. He would bring the weapons case home and run by the team to turn it in late tomorrow morning after he caught up on some desperately needed sleep. It was a 10-minute drive from Team 7 to the small house that his family had rented on the island for the past 3 years. He couldn't wait to get home. Homecomings from a war zone are difficult to describe to those who have not experienced them firsthand. They are exceedingly powerful experiences.
made all the more remarkable when children are part of the picture. Emotional floodgates that have been held at bay month after month are finally opened, allowing those feelings of love and devotion to pour through all at once. Homecomings made the deployments almost worth it. Almost. Those pent-up feelings, forced to take a six-month back seat to the mission of defending the nation, were now free to be expressed. For the Reese family, this one would be even more special. This would be their last. Reese had reached a rank where he would be precluded from leading men into combat, which is what he had joined the SEAL teams to do in the first place. That had coincided with Lucy getting to an age where she needed him around, made it a natural transition point for a man who had spent his entire adult life at war. It was time for a change, and he knew it. It was time to focus on his family. Reese thought back to his last homecoming, when Lauren had kept Lucy up way past her bedtime in anticipation of Reese's return, but not telling her why, just in case there was a delay, as happens so often with military transportation. The strains that such delayed returns placed on families could be significant. Most guys would not tell their families exactly when they were coming home, lest they disappoint them with the inevitable delay. Delays of a day seemed like a week, while a delay of a week felt like a month. Reese remembered an entire army brigade that was at the airport in Baghdad, ready to go home after a year in country, only to be turned around to fight for another 4 months. Some were even already safely back in the States and had to return to the quagmire that was Iraq. The sting of the deaths during those extended months must have been exceptionally hard to bear. Reese tried not to think of how the families of servicemen killed in action felt about the present-day struggle in the cradle of civilization. On that last return, Reese had a taxi let him off at the end of the block so as not to ruin the surprise for Lucy, doing his best not to sprint down the sidewalk to his house. He had texted Lauren that he was almost home as he crept up past the front gate in the darkness. Before knocking, he peered through the stained glass section of the door to see Lucy curled up with Lauren on the couch watching what was inevitably a Disney movie. He had paused and let his eyes mist over with emotion, looking through the colored glass at the two people he loved more than anything else in this world, his family. Lauren was stroking Lucy's hair and had looked toward the door, catching her husband's eye and smiling the most beautiful smile he had ever seen. God, she was gorgeous. Then he watched as she had whispered something in Lucy's ear and pointed at the door. Lucy had bolted from the couch with eyes as wide as saucers and a smile that would melt a glacier, rushing toward the door as fast as her young legs would carry her, her stuffed green frog clutched tightly in her small hand. Throwing open the door, Reese had taken a knee, Lucy running full speed into his outstretched arms and holding him with the strength only children hugging their parents possess, all the while repeating "Dada, Dada" over and over again, like it was the only word she knew. Reese recognized that strength for what it was, a child's unconditional love. Standing with Lucy in his arms, Reese had moved into the house and met his stunning wife halfway across the living room floor, the three of them holding each other tight, the tears of joy flowing freely.
"Welcome home, my love," Lauren had whispered. "We missed you."
Later that night, Reese read Lucy her favorite story, Where the Wild Things Are, acting out the goofy dances of the wild things so as to ensure it wasn't too scary for his daughter, and sang her favorite lullaby, Hush, Little Baby. As he concluded with, "You'll still be the sweetest little baby in town," Lucy's eyes had closed, drifting off into the innocent slumber of youth. Reese had tucked the covers around her, smiling down at his little angel and kissing her forehead. He then made sure the nightlight was plugged in before carefully and silently closing the door behind him and tiptoeing down the hall to join Lauren in the kitchen for a long overdue glass of wine before whisking her upstairs to bed. Turning off the main road and into his neighborhood, Reese was jolted out of his reverie, his heart sinking into his chest, the faint reflection of emergency lights on the treetops making the hair on the back of his neck stand up. The lights got brighter as he approached his turn, and when the cruiser made the left, his blood ran cold. Instead of the picturesque suburban scene he'd dreamed about during his entire deployment, his eyes were met by the violent flashing of red and blue lights coming from what appeared to be every police car, fire truck, and ambulance in Coronado. The emergency vehicles were scattered haphazardly in front of his home, and a uniformed officer was stringing yellow police line tape around the perimeter of his well-manicured yard to keep the gathering of neighbors from trampling the scene. The rational center of his brain knew exactly what that meant, but his emotions forced him into immediate denial. His family had to be okay. They were all he had left. Leaving the cruiser running in the middle of the street, Reese sprinted toward the front door of his home. He made it about halfway across his lawn when the officer spotted him and began yelling for him to stop. The first to reach him was a zit-faced patrol officer who looked younger than the kids showing up for buds. He stood as if the badge on his chest alone would stop the speed and momentum of the larger man. Panic set into his eyes as Reese lowered his shoulder and sent him flying over a hedge. A second officer drew his handgun but wasn't prepared to use it, and quickly found it out of his grasp. An unseen detective grabbed Reese from behind in a bear hug and got a broken collarbone for his troubles when his shoulder hit the sidewalk. More and more officers piled into the melee, and soon all of Reese's adrenaline and rage-fueled skill was overcome by the sheer mass of bodies. As officers struggled to get control of his hands, someone sprayed his face with a full blast of pepper spray that set his senses afire. The handcuffs were already locked tightly around his wrists when the youngest officer, who had caught his wind and climbed his way out from the landscaping, got his revenge, kicking Reese's prone body in the face with his black combat-style boots. A lieutenant grabbed the younger officer and four patrolmen dragged Reese toward the street and into the back seat of an idling Crown Victoria. Beaten, pepper-sprayed, and prevented from knowing the fate of his wife and daughter, Reese was suddenly overcome by the events of the past week. He'd lost the Seal brothers he had sworn to lead, was kept from their funerals, scapegoated by a bureaucracy who helped seal their fates, lost another teammate to a supposed suicide, and now faced the possibility that the two people he loved most in the world were gone, too. Lying on his side with his hands cuffed behind his back, he began to sob uncontrollably. The overwhelming emotions combined with the effects of the pepper spray turned the hardened warrior into a quivering mess. His body shook, he hyperventilated, and tears and mucus ran down his face and onto the seat of the patrol car. He had nothing left to give, and nothing left to lose. Chapter 11. Unlike the manipulative interrogation he'd faced at the hands of the NCIS investigators in Bagram, the questions posed by the local detectives were non-accusatory. This physical evidence made it clear that this was not the act of a jealous husband or a guy looking to rid himself of the responsibilities that life had heaped upon him. The full auto gunfire reported by the neighbors made the timeline for the home invasion and subsequent murders clear. And his alibi at Balboa was rock solid. The investigators had spoken to his CO before they'd even questioned him, and were already familiar with how Reese had spent the day. Reese sat emotionless as the detectives described to him the horrific crimes that would shock his serene community. 3 to 4 men, undoubtedly armed with AKMs, judging by the steel 7.62x39mm cases that littered the scene, began firing into the home as they approached the front door. They kicked it in and continued firing as they worked their way through the rooms of the home, spraying rounds indiscriminately as they went. His wife was found face down in the bedroom closet, shielding little Lucy's body with her own as she took her last breaths. It appeared as if she'd wounded at least one of the shooters with the handgun she'd hastily grabbed from a small gun safe close to the bed. There was 9mm brass inside the closet and a blood trail that led out of the house. Lauren's wounds indicated that she was hit in the hands and arms while defending herself before she moved to cover her daughter and was killed by close-range rifle shots that took both of their lives. An entire 30-round magazine appeared to have been emptied into Lauren at point-blank range. Death would have been more or less instantaneous from the multiple hits to her vital organs. Lucy was still clinging to life when the ambulance arrived, but her badly broken body could fight no longer, and she died on the way to the hospital. The paramedics fought like lions to save her, but the trauma was too great. There was no indication of sexual battery on either body or any sign of theft, probably due to Lauren's brave resistance that wounded one of the shooters. Neighbors saw the men flee the scene in a black Cadillac sedan. The detectives' working hypothesis was that this was the work of a crew of gang members from across the bay in Barrio Logan. They'd been increasingly suspected in taggings and property crimes in otherwise crime-free Coronado, and had obviously upped the ante in committing such a brutal home invasion. Reese listened to their narrative, knowing full well that this was no random act of violence by a crew of gangbangers, but neither was it the work of trained professionals. There was one last thing, the detectives told him, almost hesitatingly. Lauren had been pregnant. The little boy had been conceived just before Reese's deployment, according to how far along she was. Lauren had kept it a secret, a surprise to make his final homecoming especially memorable. He thought the pain couldn't have been any greater, but the news drove him deeper into despair. While Reese met with the investigators, the crime scene team continued to process evidence at his home. Philip Dubin had wanted to be a police detective as long as he could remember. He came from a long line of Boston cops, and, much to his mother's chagrin, had never changed course. She had a momentary glimmer of hope when he had enlisted in the Navy, hoping he would use his GI Bill to become a doctor or a lawyer, but instead, Phil used his GI Bill to attend John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York City, graduating at the top of his class. As upset as his mother was that he chose the family profession, she was even more dismayed that he decided to settle down across the country in San Diego, where he had spent the majority of his Navy time. He had caught the tail end of the first Gulf War, spending most of that time in the bowels of a minesweeper, which did nothing to encourage him to pursue a career at sea. Stationed on the West Coast, he fell in love with the weather, the beaches, and the laid-back atmosphere, which were all in stark contrast to his upbringing on the streets of Boston. He met his wife while she was working in the district attorney's office. She now ran their household full-time. After 20 years on the San Diego Police Department, he had attained the rank of lieutenant in the homicide division. Happily married and with three kids of their own, Phil could not imagine a more ideal life. He had a job he loved and a family he loved even more. Detective Dubin had a tough time separating the cop in him from the husband and father as he slowly made his way through Reese's front yard. He had been called to the beautiful resort town that was Coronado on a few occasions for work, once for a brutal murder-suicide and another time for a questionable suicide by hanging. Coronado had detectives to handle such investigations, but when there was a link to the city across the bay, they would reach out for assistance from the SDPD. After checking in and nodding to a few familiar faces, Phil climbed the front steps, knowing that the grislier parts of the crime scene awaited him. He had seen a lot in his career as a cop, but no father could ever get used to something like this. The nights he spent on murder investigations where young lives had been taken always caused him to pause and appreciate his own kids just a bit more when he got home.
"Hey, Phil."
"Hey, Chuck," Phil responded to the local detective.
"How bad is it?" "This one is rough. We don't get a lot of this over here, as you know. Thanks for coming."
"No problem. What do you have?"
"Looks like a home invasion, though we've never seen anything like this before out here. Hard to believe it's random. I just don't know why a bunch of gangbangers would want to hit a small house in Coronado.
Phil nodded and looked past the small-town detective, who continued to fill him in. The carpet was soaked in blood, and the room was littered with shell casings marked by numbered yellow markers. Watching the medical examiner bag up a dead body was something Phil never got used to, and seeing the lifeless form of what had only hours before been a vibrant and beautiful woman caused the Boston native to look away. That was Lauren Reese. She was Signal 7 when the first units arrived on the scene. They found her daughter under her, still alive. Paramedics rushed her to the hospital, but she didn't make it. Multiple bullet wounds. Looks like the mom got a few rounds off with a Glock. We found a 19 and some spent brass close to her body, some blood in the hallway, and some more by the front door. The mom and daughter were shot in here, so we think she hit at least one of them.
Any chance this was the husband?
Phil asked. He had seen his share of domestic problems turn violent.
Surprisingly not.
A neighbor gave us a good vehicle description and multiple perps. The husband is a Navy guy and was at Balboa Hospital all afternoon. We are interviewing him now, but it looks unlikely.
Thanks, Chuck. I'm just going to look around a bit. Our gang task force guys will be here soon.
Okay. Let me know if you figure anything out. Phil began to explore the home, trying to get a sense of what this family was like when they were alive. He wanted to understand them so he could make assessments and attempt to decipher what had caused their lives to end so violently in this normally safe section of San Diego. He entered a room off the bedroom that looked to be the home office.
Why would a gang hit this particular home?
When Phil had started in police work, he would always go straight to the family photo albums. More than once, the story he gleaned from those family memories helped connect certain dots and allowed the young police officer to break a case. These days, hardly anyone kept family albums. Photos were spread out over different computers and hard drives and online accounts, making it exceedingly difficult to use them the way he had back in the 1990s. Now he used the photos on the walls and desks and dressers instead. Phil took in the room methodically. Not messy, but not particularly clean. Lived in would be the more apt term. Things looked organized, but not remarkably so. At first glance, it looked like a typical home office, but it quickly became apparent that there was something different about this family. Phil's eyes were immediately drawn to a wall containing three tomahawks of varying sizes.
You don't see that every day in San Diego.
Though he knew next to nothing about the weapons mounted to the office wall, he thought one reminded him of something out of the movie Last of the Mohicans. A more modern-looking one was attached to a plaque above a group photo of men in full military battle gear standing around a bombed-out building. Operators. Two of the men held a black flag with Arabic writing. All looked like serious people you'd want on your side in a fight. The plaque read, "To Lieutenant James Reese from the Men of Alpha Platoon." A skeleton of a frog was engraved under that with the warning, "Don't fuck with us," above a list of close to 30 names. Phil stepped back and took in the remainder of the room.
Who is this guy?
What Phil recognized as a samurai sword rested under glass in a presentation frame on the opposite wall. It looked old. Not like the imitation ones Phil had seen for sale in shops downtown. A small brass plate was glued inside the glass under the sword. Phil bent forward to look more closely. Lieutenant J.G. Thomas Reese, Scouts and Raiders, 1945.
Not a normal house and not a normal guy,
Phil thought, moving to the desk and picking up a family photograph. James and Lauren Reese looking back at him. Even in the picture, he could tell these were special people. Both were beaming with joy, James holding his young daughter in his arms, Lauren's arm around him with her head on his shoulder. It must have been before some sort of formal event since James was wearing his dress blues, the unmistakable seal trident gleaming off his chest. Phil pulled the photo closer. Was that a silver star? And next to that a bronze star with a V adorned with two stars on either side? Though Phil had only served 4 years in the Navy, he knew the trident well. His time on the minesweeper was spent with a few guys who had tried the famed SEAL training program and failed out for various reasons along the way. Phil looked back to the medals on Reese's chest, and then back around the room, noting that none of the medal